Hello, friends. This is the Environment Show, and welcome. In California, they call it Big Green. At the polls, it will be listed as Proposition 128. In the second of our series of regional surveys of environmental issues confronting voters next month, we'll take another look at this proposition. Also, fighting City Hall sure never looked like this. North Carolina Attorney John Pike advertised for help in fending off a proposed waste incinerator.
The night I announced it, we had about 2,000 people come into my office. It was a holiday weekend, Memorial Day weekend, and it was everybody from young children to old people, rich, poor, black, white. It was everybody that cared, and apparently a whole lot of people cared.
To date, 9,623 people have joined, and we'll tell you what they did. And pianist Michael Jones. These stories this time on The Environment Show, a national production of WAMC made possible by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York, and this is Bruce Robertson. When California voters go to the polls next month, one of the most controversial measures they will confront is a piece of proposed legislation called Big Green. In our series surveying the nation's environmental ballot initiatives, Joy Newell reports from Los Angeles on the status of Proposition 128.
Those in favor of Proposition 128 point out that the oil and chemical companies are financing the opposition and another more conservative ballot measure. Those who oppose the measure take every opportunity to point out that Tom Hayden is one of its principal backers and that Hayden would apparently be delighted to take the position of so-called energy czar provided for in the initiative. The feeling seems to be that association with Hayden's name will make the initiative seem too radical. At a recent conference for journalists who cover the environment, coverage of Proposition 128 was a constant source of conversation. The journalists expressed frustration at the complexity of the measure itself, and knowing that voters are likely to vote as an expression against Hayden or against the oil companies, rather than for the contents of the initiative. Big Green, or Proposition 128, would preserve old-growth redwood forests. It would impose new taxes on oil companies to pay for oil spill prevention and cleanup. But perhaps one of the most controversial parts of the initiative involves chemicals connected to the depletion of the ozone layer. The measure calls for a reduction of carbon dioxide emissions from cars and asks for a 40% reduction by the year 2010. Stephen Moss, an economist, analyzed Proposition 128 for clients, the California Chambers of Commerce, and California manufacturers. Moss feels Proposition 128 tries to accomplish too much too rapidly.
In order to get those kind of reductions, what you really need to do is change people's behavior on a massive level. About half of the emissions come from automobiles. So you either have to get a lot of people out of their cars, or you got to change the way people use cars. Using California Energy Commission models, what you come up with is an effective gas tax as a result of that of 40 to 70 cents. And other analysts have come up with the same thing. The Congressional Budget Office has come up with a 50-cent gas tax. EPA comes up with a 70-cent gas tax. Another consulting company came up with a 50-cent gas tax. And what a gas tax does is it encourages people to use their cars less, so it drives down driving, reduces emissions, and then you collect the money you need and you put it into mass transit and alternatives to cars so that you can build out of a car society.
Moss says as far as food production and pesticides go, consumers will have to adjust to not having all the produce they want at whatever time of year they want it, because the use of pesticides has improved year-round production of many fruits and vegetables.
In my judgment, it's basically bad public policy. It tries to address issues that we're all worried about, but the way it's written, it ends up not addressing them very effectively, and it costs us more money than it really needs to.
Moss's approach to the pesticide question involves a marketplace point of view rather than a social one.
With pesticides, for example, my personal opinion is that if you don't like pesticides and you want to get away from them, you should tax them, sort of like a sin tax on alcohol and the like. Then you can collect the revenue you need. You can encourage farmers not to use them as much. You can phase out of them and use the revenues you get from the tax to invest in alternative ways of growing foods.
Dave Bunn of Pesticide Watch supports Big Green. His view is that if something is dangerous for people's health, it should not be taxed. It simply should not be used by the agriculture sector.
The food safety / pesticide issue has been, blocked for years by special interests such as the pesticide companies and major food processors, and there's been really no progress in that area within the state. It's just that agribusiness in the U.S. has enormous power, and they've been successful at blocking any reforms in those areas.
In other words, Bunn says, if voters wait for the government to clean up the environment and get the pesticides out of their lives, They're going to be disappointed. Moss and his company, Spectrum Economics, feel the principal problem with the initiative is that it tries to do too much, and no one knows exactly what it will be able to accomplish.
I think the major complaint that the proponents have is that the political system has not been taking care of important environmental problems. So I think I would place my energy behind putting in representatives, governors, assembly people, senators, and the like, that will be sensitive to environmental problems, that will go about legislating correct solutions. I think my strategy would be to put a little more targeted, a little more clearly written proposition on the ballot so we understand a little better what we're voting for.
But Moss admits there will be voters who will vote for Big Green for what they consider very good reasons.
Well, the only reason I would vote for it is if my frustration level was so high and I was so fed up and I distrusted the system so much and that I'd almost in a sense given up hope in the current way that politics is done in California, that I felt I had to do this. I had no other choice. Then I would go ahead and vote for it. But the chances of sort of damage from the proposition are higher than the chances for benefits in my estimation.
The proponents of Proposition 128 believe that government has been co-opted and strangled to the point that voters, through the initiative process, must take the law into their own hands. For the Environment Show in Los Angeles, I'm Joy Newell.
Joy Newell reports for the Environment Show from member station KCRW in Santa Monica. Heard the phrase, not in my backyard, NIMBY, as in, I'm not against the landfill, I just don't want it in my backyard. Well, you may or may not have heard this story.
My name is John Pike. I'm a lawyer in a small town in Piedmont, North Carolina, Granville County, North Carolina. Our county was targeted as a potential site for a hazardous waste incinerator, and I have tried to be as oppositional to that sighting as possible.
So far, just another story of citizens fighting the government and industry. Pike here was confronting the North Carolina Hazardous Waste Management Commission that had selected the town of Oxford to be the location to receive hazardous materials from a five-state region, North Carolina, South Carolina, Alabama, Kentucky, and Tennessee. Possibly also, he says, even from the Northeast. Using friends, though, that he never knew he had, John Pike has been fighting this plan, and he believes he has won. Before we find out what you did, what is it about that tract of land that is not suitable to your way of thinking?
Well, the tract that was selected was less than a mile from our corporate limits, and we're a town of 8,000 people, and the impact of such a facility on our town and our entire county would have just been devastating, and it essentially would have killed us, killed the county, and that doesn't even examine the potential health effects and of incineration and the potential health effects of accident and spills and groundwater contamination. So,
the tract that was under consideration was 580 acres, was, until John Pike came along.
I bought a 48-acre piece of land that went 3,000 feet into the center of their project and immediately began selling undivided interests to as many people as possible. Within a week, I had sold 70,000 undivided interests to as many as 4,000 people. As of today, there are now 9,623 owners of that 48-acre piece of land. And it will cost the state of North Carolina approximately, between $5 and $10 million to condemn and negotiate with all those people. And quite frankly, I don't think they'll do it.
So this lends new meaning to the phrase divide and conquer at this point then.
that's lovely. I like that. That's exactly what we've done. The land, of course, will be ours in perpetuity, and we intend to turn it into a public access area, public wilderness area, and be good stewards of the land. And We did, in fact, divide, and I think we probably have, in fact, conquered. The state has abandoned this track. They haven't abandoned it, but they've moved us down in priority, citing difficulties in condemnation as the reason.
Who were these people who went in on this with you, who bought these small tracts of land?
We had everybody. The night I announced it, we had about 2,000 people come into my office. It was a holiday weekend, Memorial Day weekend, and it was everybody from young children to old people, rich, poor, black, white. It was everybody that cared, and apparently a whole lot of people cared. We made national TV, and we got calls, and we had people buying the land from as far away as South America, Europe. All 50 states are now represented in the Jones Land Environmental Park.
Unless the new owners deed this property to someone else, they own it in perpetuity. Now, don't get the wrong idea here. We're not talking about owning a mountaintop or something.
If you were dividing it up into an actual plot, it would be about 5x6, about the size of a gravesite.
So a place where you could just sort of go and stand and say, this is mine.
That's about it.
What are some of the, or what were and will be, some of the legal ramifications or legal procedures by which an individual could buy that small a piece of land?
Well, keep in mind that they're not really buying that piece of land. They're buying a share in the whole. So you don't know where your little piece of land is. All you know is you own it with a bunch of other people.
According to Pike, the commission has all but pulled out of the Oxford site, favoring instead a tract of land about 10 miles to the south, a site that Pike says he'll fight as well. Well, Mr. Pike, what gave you the idea for this particular strategy that's really kind of unique?
Well, I'm a lawyer, and I just happen to be the lawyer for the people that own this tract of land. They needed to sell it because they needed to pay some taxes and some other costs that had been incurred in dividing the land among the heirs. There were like 14 people that owned this particular tract of land, and it had taken us a number of years to find all of the cousins and nieces and nephews and everybody. And it occurred to me that if it took us several years to find anywhere from 15 to 50, then think how long it would take and how much cost would be involved in finding thousands. That gave me the seed, and as I said, I knew who owned it, I knew where they were, and I knew they wanted to and needed to sell it, and I gave them a fair price for it. So that's what started it. I also had been involved in some developers tried to buy and develop a sand dune on the Outer Banks of North Carolina. And then a group got together and bought the sand dune, and then they sold little pieces of it, fictional shares, fictional square inches for a dollar. Now, they were selling a fiction. What I'm selling is a real undivided interest in a piece of land. So it's real, but that's where I got the idea, and I think it's been effective.
Pike says owning a piece of North Carolina is surprisingly simple.
You don't have to do anything. The current owner of the land is Jones Land Environmental Park, Inc., which is a nonprofit corporation. The Jones Land Park deeds it out to you. Your name goes on the deed. It's recorded and registered in the Office of the Register of Deeds here in Granville County, and that's where it stays. You don't have to do anything to it, for it, with it, or against it.
No taxes owed on that?
No. If you tried to tax a 1/70,000th undivided interest in a 48-acre piece of land, the tax would be probably 0.5 cents. So they will exempt it from taxation. Plus, we are nonprofit, so there would be no taxes. My best recommendation would be to come on down and visit us and enjoy the land and be assured that we're going to take good care of it.
Pike says this strategy can be applied to either a vast wilderness or a size as small as an acre.
What I did was perfectly legal and legitimate. I bought a piece of land and I sold a piece of land. I just happened to sell it to a bunch of people.
The initial funds to buy the land have already been raised. Pike says now additional monies are needed to set up nature trails, picnic areas, camping areas, and programs to sustain the area in its natural state.
Mr. Pike, thank you very much.
You've been very cooperative
and a lot of fun.
Right.
Okay now.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
John Pike practices law in Oxford, North Carolina, and he says to date, 9,623 people have signed up. This is The Environment Show. I'm Bruce Robertson. Next week...
I think the most important myth that we have to get through in the post-Reagan years is the notion that when it comes to the environment, government and industry are natural enemies. I think our book is established, and the hazardous waste experience is established, that the only way you can achieve environmental excellence is for government and industry to work together.
A conversation with Dr. Bruce Piasecki, author of In Search of Environmental Excellence. The book is subtitled Moving Beyond Blame. It's not just another how-to book. That's next week. We hope you'll be listening. Pianist Michael Jones released his first album in 1983 on the Milwaukee-based Narada label. In fact, Jones was the first artist to record with Narada. Since then, Narada has gone on to become what Billboard magazine last year ranked as the number one label of what is called New Age music, music that generally has a dreamy, meditative, sort of organic quality to it. The label has recently released a very special collection of music representing all of the artists that record for Narada. The album, The Wilderness Collection, is described as a 16-song ode to the wilderness. There is a political agenda behind the album, too. Proceeds from the sale of The Wilderness Collection will be divided between the National Audubon Society, the Sierra Club, and the Wilderness Society. For his contribution, Jones wrote a piece called Wildflowers. We'll hear a bit of it in a moment. On a recent national tour, Jones stopped by to visit us at the Environment Show.
When I was when I was going to camp as a teenager, I can remember being out in these wilderness waters and empty lakes, listening to the loons. And when I came back to camp, I felt this real urge to find some way musically that I could share the experience I had out there with other people. And I would sit by this great big screened-in part of the main dining lodge at the camp, and we were up in this part of the real rocky Canadian Shield in Georgian Bay, north of Toronto. And as the wind would kind of whip through or the rain would come through, I'd be sitting there playing something that just felt that I had that feeling. And I guess over the years, as I spent time at that, it got contagious. People could sense that. And so when they were hearing the music, they could feel wind or they could feel rain or they could imagine the sunlight dancing on the water and these kinds of things.
Jones actually began playing the piano when he was just 2. Jones, now 47, eventually went on to study formally at the Toronto Royal Academy of Music, eventually changing direction, though, entering the business world. His music, though, would not stop. Playing informally, Jones shared with his friends at home what came to be known as Michael's music, music that we now have on 9 albums. Jones describes his music as a blend of classical and contemporary styles, the two really coming together on one particular occasion when he was asked to accompany a modern dance class. The teacher said, "Play something with rain in it."
And so, feeling a bit nervous and insecure, I went to my box of music, leafing through it for something with rain in the title. And she quickly came over and somewhat impatiently said, "No, I don't mean something written. I mean something with the real feeling of it." And she demonstrated. She had some piano ability and demonstrated very lightly in the upper keys. And so I copied what she was doing. And then she went back and the dancers started to move. And then she paused for a moment and said, "Now, Michael, play something with wind in it." And I said, "Wind." just beginning to get the feeling of rain. And then she gestured with her left hand and gave me a hint as to how to work with it. So I started to do something with the feeling of wind. And it was wonderful. For a while, I was really frustrated because I said, you know, I've studied all these composers at college, but nobody ever trained me or taught me how to play Wind or Rain on the piano. But it wasn't. But it also connected me to when I was a kid when I used to do this. And then she said, no, play Thunder. And we moved through a whole realm of different kind of really nature-oriented sensory experience. It's a little piece called After the Rain.
Jones further describes his music as not really entertainment, but more environment, and that was a characteristic that apparently made it most suitable for the Narada collection, the Wilderness collection.
I think I speak for other artists, and certainly for myself, when I say that we're inspired by the wilderness. I mean, that's really where the music comes from, and where art comes from, I think, is the connection with not the civilized environment, but the wildness of the environment, the kind of chaos that's there as a part of what you experience creatively, that you work with and in some way dance with or bring into some kind of order. And whether I spend a lot of time out in the wilderness or not, knowing that it's there is an essential part of my own creative process. We're so connected to it in such a deep way that when we lose the wilderness, we also lose art.
Yeah. And I've noted in your music and in others in that collection a serenity, a peaceful feeling, interpreting the wilderness and its feeling.
Mm-hmm.
But to humans as something that's peaceful and serene, the majesty and the beauty. What do you do, though, with overdevelopment, landfills, toxic water, air pollution that is in the wilderness also? How do you express that? Or is that not what you're trying to capture or share with your music?
Well, I think what I try to do in the music is to what I'm drawn to in the music. What appeals to me is the purity of seeing nature in its original form, and the purity and the clarity of that is what I try to bring through. I'm certainly aware of the variety of ways in which it's contaminated. It's around me all the time.
I guess that's what I was asking. How does that inform your playing and your composing? That sense of being the outrage. Or the sadness of watching it happen?
I think there's a sadness in some of my music that would reflect the sadness that I feel, a collective sadness of just what, you know, just what's there. And there is certainly some darker and sadder moments on the Wilderness collection that I think is a reflection of how many of the artists are feeling about the loss we feel for the source of our inspiration and how difficult it is now to find it in its pure form, how quickly it's disappearing. I see that with all the growth that's happening, even though I've gone to a very pristine part of Ontario, that the people have images of Canada as being a very pristine country, and yet we're still dealing with many of the kind of environmental problems that the United States is. And I certainly feel that sadness. I feel the loss. I feel the frustration and the anger, the stupidity of the things we've done. And an acknowledgement, and I guess having lived in a busy city like Toronto for many years, I did let the music take me into places that were reflective of my own imagination. I called the composition that I composed Wildflowers, and it's a reflection of the sense that whenever I play and transport myself to the mountains or wherever, that there's that beautiful sense of color and joy and almost celebration. It's as if flowers give back the sense of what they received. It's like the sun gives life to the flowers in turn give their blessing back to the sun.
And you can conjure that feeling, that image, no matter where you're playing, no matter what keyboard you're sitting in, what building or room that you're in?
I think more and more as I've been at the piano, there's a consistency now with which I can simply allow the music to take me into that place outside and both inside and outside at the same time.
pianist Michael Jones. As he played, I found myself feeling somewhat disconnected and dreamy. He, too, seemed calm and transported somewhere. He looked peaceful and, well, hopeful. And he says he is hopeful. His music has taught him to be more aware of the rift that has developed between humans and the environment. We need to heal that broken relationship, he says.
And in that sense, I think that the artists in the world are going to be as integral to this process as are the scientists. It's not that one is going to be more critical than the other, but there is something in art that does offer us that intuitive connection, which I think gives us a different sense of how we honor our world and how we become a part of its not only its healing, but our healing. Because I don't think we can heal the environment without healing a lot of what we carry within us that has historically been very adversarial as we fight with ourselves and with the world around us. I think that's all been a reflection of it.
Pianist Michael Jones, he and his wife Judy live in a rural wilderness area of Ontario, Canada. His composition, Wildflowers, is contained on the Narada album, The Wilderness Collection. This is Bruce Robertson. And that's our show for this week. We hope you enjoyed The Environment Show. Our piece on Michael Jones was recorded by James Schofield. The Environment Show is a weekly half-hour program about the environment, the air, water, soil, wildlife, and people of our common habitat. If you know of something happening in your area that you think we ought to know about, or if you have a question about this week's or any week's Environment Show, feel free to drop us a line. Address your questions and comments to The Environment Show, WAMC, 318 Central Avenue in Albany, New York, and the zip code is 12206. From Michigan to Louisiana, New Jersey to Oregon, this is The Environment Show. Before we go, welcome to a new station to The Environment Show Network. Hello to good friends listening to KHKE 89.5 FM, broadcasting from the University of Northern Iowa, Cedar Falls, Iowa. Welcome, and we hope you'll be listening next week. The Environment Show is a national production of WAMC. Dr. Alan Shartok is executive producer. This is Bruce Robertson. The Environment Show is made possible by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York.